Thanks for listening to Soundside. This show is only possible because listeners support us. If you're able to give right now, please check out the show notes for a link to donate. And don't forget, you can listen live on KUOW 94.9 FM Seattle at noon and 8 p.m. Monday through Thursday, or anytime online at KUOW.org. A quick content warning, this next story does include descriptions of sexual assault and murder. Solving a cold case, like a decades-old murder, seems, on an ethical level, pretty simple. I mean, as a society, we can agree that it's important to give families closure, information about what happened to their loved one, and a suspect. But what is the cost of that closure? And are we all willing to give up some privacy for it? To show law enforcement the data that makes you fundamentally you, and arguably the most private data we have, our genes. Genetic information is increasingly used by law enforcement, like police and federal agents, to find people who have committed murders or sexual assaults. Cases that have gone cold. And we're talking really cold here. Like, for how long, Claire?
Like, up to 50 years in some cases.
Mm. That's KUOW's Claire McGrain. She brings us this next story about the growing use of genetic information by law enforcement and the complicated, sticky ethical concerns that it can raise. Okay, Claire, where should we start?
Well, I think before we really dig into it, we should just level set, make sure we're on the same page.
Okay.
So this technique is called forensic genetic genealogy. Straight off the dome, does that mean anything to you?
Forensic sounds like you're using genes to solve crimes.
Yeah, essentially. The key here is it's not just the genes of someone who committed a crime. It's also the genes of their family members.
Hmm.
That's where this gets really sticky, like you said, in a legal sense. So one of the highest profile genetic genealogy investigations ever was a case here in Washington. And I want to share a diary entry with you from someone who was kind of caught up in this investigation.
May 17th, 2018.
Her name is Chelsea Rustad. She's like a very normal person. She has a normal job. She lives down in Tumwater.
I finished work, then came home and watched Dear White People with Ben.
You know, was living her life, watching some TV, and the police showed up on her doorstep.
I was pretty weirded out at first, but they said they were here because they were investigating a family member for murder.
Specifically, sheriff's officers from Snohomish County. And they said, hey, remember that DNA test that you took?
They said that my genealogical research and DNA data had been instrumental in solving the murder, which is crazy.
Whoa.
Yeah.
That is a really intense thing to have show up at your door with no warning.
Absolutely. And, you know, Chelsea said she was kind of freaked out, like that she didn't feel very comfortable around law enforcement. But when she realized why they were there and the fact that a murderer was behind bars, in theory, because of her, she thought, I'm kind of okay with that. I'll let you in. I'll talk with you.
I invited them in and we went over my family tree, how we're connected, how I did my research, and I shared my Rustad family tree with Officer Fred Harrison. They said that information will be released to the press tomorrow about the case. They also seemed interested in getting my DNA raw data, but unless they need that to convict the guy, I'm not volunteering it.
So this is a huge moment for genetic genealogy in our state in particular. This was only the second ever case to be solved with this technique, and it was the first one that ever resulted in a trial. And since then, there have been hundreds of cases where forensic genetic genealogy was key to solving them. Our Attorney General's office in Washington has a program, and it's really embroiled in one of the highest profile murder cases of the past few years, the University of Idaho murders.
Wow.
And this all really started the day that police showed up at Chelsea's door.
So what happened in this case that eventually Chelsea's DNA helped solve? What was the murder that the police were trying to track down?
Yeah, this was a case that had gone cold for more than 30 years. And I think it's a great explanation of how forensic genetic genealogy works, actually. So I'm going to walk you through it. And I know a lot about it because I covered this extensively. Probably know more about it than you need to know. But the basic facts are this. The crime that led those officers to Chelsea's door happened in 1987. And the victims were a young couple, Jay Cook and Tanya Van Kylenberg. And they're actually not from Washington. They lived in Victoria on Vancouver Island. And they were running an errand for Jay's dad down to Seattle. They had to pick up some parts for the family business. They drove the family van down, we think, to Seattle. They were supposed to pick the parts up and drive back the next day, but they entirely disappeared. They didn't show up at the shop when they were supposed to, and their bodies were found about a week later. Jay's in Monroe, Tanya's off a highway in Skagit County. And then their van was found in Bellingham. So this was a really horrible crime. It came totally out of the blue.
And it seems like police didn't find much success when they initially investigated this, right? I mean, how did it end up going cold for 30 years?
Well, they had a few pieces of evidence that they were hopeful would lead them to a suspect. There was like a palm print on the van. There were these industrial strength zip ties that were really not common at the time. But one of the key problems is a lot of murders, the victim knows the suspect. And Tanya and Jay didn't know anyone in Seattle. So this was a stranger. There was no connection that the police could follow. But they had one very key piece of evidence, which is a sample of semen that was found on Tanya's body and on her clothes in the van. So police assumed the suspect must have left this sample, and they called this unknown person Individual A. At the time, DNA evidence was pretty early. They kind of knew DNA could be helpful, but it wasn't quite to the point where it was going to immediately be helpful. But a couple years later, they were able to sequence that sample and upload it to this database run by the FBI called CODIS, which you might have heard of on Law & Order or Criminal Minds or NCIS or any of a million crime shows. They eventually sequenced the DNA sample, uploaded it to CODIS. Nothing. No hits.
Well, I'd imagine that in order to get a hit on CODIS, you'd have to have somebody who's in the system already, somebody who had committed a crime where the police were going to be collecting their DNA. And that wasn't the case here?
It was not the case here. This person apparently had never been arrested for anything like this. And CODIS is kind of the widest reaching law enforcement DNA database. But it's also quite narrow. You can upload DNA information to it, and it will return either, yes, this person's here, or no, they're not. And that was that. Really, the case went cold. They never had any serious suspects. And for 31 years, authorities kept kind of coming back to it and looking for different ways to approach it without success.
Yeah, fast forward 30 years. How does this case crack open again?
So to explain that, we have to get into consumer DNA testing. Have you ever done one of these like Ancestry or 23andMe tests?
No, I have seen them, of course, everybody talking about, oh, I'm X percentage from this country. And I feel like 5 years ago or so, this was the hottest gift at the holiday time. But I have never done one, no.
Yeah, I haven't either. But my understanding is it's very simple. You swab your cheek and then you put that swab in a little tube and mail it off to one of these companies. And there is a lot of information in your DNA, like way too much information. We don't really need all of that information to do things like figure out what our heritage is, because a lot of it is just, hey, grow an organ here, or this is how your hair should work. So a lot of it is not relevant to your heritage or how you're related to people. So these companies just sequence key parts of your DNA that they can use to identify what part of the world you're from, identify relatives that you have in their database, and then they return that information to you. You get the sheet of your 24% Finnish and all that kind of stuff.
But they also collect a whole ton of information about a whole lot of people because these things are very popular.
Oh, yes. And here's something you might be surprised to learn. These companies don't have to follow HIPAA, the Healthcare Information Privacy Act.
Whoa.
Yeah. This is a big issue in genetic privacy. Basically, that data is available for those companies to mine however they want to.
Okay, so I'm starting to see where this might be going. So did Chelsea herself take one of these tests? How did this end up you know, moving from this is fun, I'm going to find out where my, you know, where my ancestry is from, to, hey, I might have a family member involved in a crime.
Yeah. Chelsea did take one of these tests. She actually won it. She won it in a contest. She is really into genealogical research, so researching her family, her great-grandparents, finding out their names and what they did. And as part of this interest, she saw a contest, the prize of which was an ancestry kit. And she entered the contest and won and sent off her swab. Now, one of the weird things about this system is if you take a test with Ancestry.com or 23andMe, you get put into their database. And if a relative of yours takes a test from another company, you can't really connect them up. You can't, like, compare. So there are also these public DNA platforms. One of them is called GEDmatch, where you can upload the file you get, the information file, and it will do kind of the same thing. It will connect you with relatives. And a lot of people use this to search for relatives, actually. Maybe you have a family member you've lost touch with or something along those lines. And a lot of adoptees use them to find their biological family.
Mm.
Now, as these databases grew and the public platforms grew, police realized they could use them to identify family members of suspects. So that individual A, in this case, in Tanya and Jay's murder, maybe they could find relatives on a public database and use that information to identify them.
Cops are going, we have this genetic material, this body fluid that was found on Tanya's body. It's been sitting there. We've sequenced it for 30 years. And this may finally be the key, now that we have all this public genetic information starting to become available, to figuring out what happened to her and Jay.
Yeah, exactly. And this idea was around for a little bit, but it kind of took one case breaking the ice, so to speak. And the case that did that was the Golden State Killer, who was a prolific murderer, rapist, broke into tons of homes in California. That case was solved with forensic genetic genealogy. So authorities announced that they have caught the Golden State Killer. And literally the same day, the Snohomish authorities that had been looking into Jay and Tanya's murder for 30 years leapt into action. They said, we want to do this too. They teamed up with a genetic genealogist who uploaded the DNA sample from Tanya's body to that site I mentioned, GEDmatch. And they were connected with two relatives, a second cousin on either side of this person, individual A. Pop quiz time, Libby. How many second cousins do you have?
Oh boy, I really have no idea. I'm not quite sure what a second cousin is, if I'm going to be honest. I have a very small, like, immediate family, and that's pretty much it.
You might have more than you think. So your parents' cousins, their children are your second cousins. So in my case, my parents have a lot of cousins. They come from some big families. So I have on the order of dozens, if not hundreds, of second cousins, and I've met maybe five or six of them in my lifetime. It's not people who you know. Like Chelsea Rustad, when police officers showed up at her door, didn't know the person they were talking about, had never met him, had kind of seen his name. But for genetic genealogy, this is a pretty close hit, your second cousins. The technique will actually work under certain conditions on third cousins or fourth cousins, like relatives really far removed. So,
but how does it work? Because say you have a suspect's DNA in front of you, you're an investigator, and you go on these public genealogy websites and you see, hey, this person has some relatives out there. You still have to do detective work, right? You still have to go and find out who in this person's family tree could possibly be the person with this exact genetic match, right? I mean, how does it work, actually?
Yeah, this is a lot like traditional reporting. It's a lot of using public records. So things like birth certificates, death certificates, marriage certificates. You basically start filling the names in the family tree of the relatives who you've got matches for. Things like social media as well. Think about your Facebook profile. It's probably clear on your Facebook profile, even to someone you're not friends with, if you have brothers and sisters or cousins that you have friended, right? So genealogists will fill out the family tree. And in this case, remember, they got a hit on either side of the family. So the two relatives that they got hits on are not related to each other, but they're both related to individual A. So essentially, the genealogist is trying to solve this puzzle to find the exact spot where these families overlap.
But when Chelsea decided to put her information out there by taking this test and then uploading it to a public website, she probably had no idea that she was providing a research tool for law enforcement to zero in on her family, however distant, in order to solve crimes.
Yeah, she didn't. This was not something that the platforms even suggested could happen if people uploaded DNA. And something she said really kind of resonated with me, and I think explains a lot of the attitude around this technique, which is that she felt a little icky about it, but she could not argue with the ends. That if a murderer was being put behind bars, she was okay with her information being used that way, even though she hadn't consented. That we're going to get there. That is a really, really big question when it comes to forensic genetic genealogy. So the genealogist found Chelsea and this other relative and started narrowing in on the place where their family trees overlap. And it turns out there is only one kind of nuclear family, the Talbots, where the trees overlap. They live just a few miles from where Jay's body was found. And in that family, there was only one male. And his name was William Earl Talbot Jr. And eventually, police tailed him and got a DNA sample from him that they confirmed matched the sample that they had from the crime scene. But really, the whole process leading up to finding this person took a couple of days. After 31 years, it only took a few days to have a name and a face and an address where this person lived.
Wow, so after decades of wondering and trying to find their own form of closure, these family members of Jay Cook and Tanya Van Kylenberg are suddenly handed this information that police have a suspect.
Yeah, and I spoke at length with Tanya's best friend at the time she died. Her name is Mae Robinson, and she told me that she was just overjoyed when she heard about the arrest.
I felt like for the next week or so, I was just floating, just such relief and disbelief that now, finally, they've got him. They've actually got him. And the technology used to ID this suspect, there's one thing to get a lead and then a suspect, and then you're, you know, maybe not sure for whatever reason, but with the technology being so compelling, it was really too good to be true, a dream come true, just incredible news.
So for May, knowing who did this to her friend was huge. And not only knowing who did it and having a name, but being able to go sit in a courtroom in the same space and see justice happening was huge for her.
I just wanted to see how tall he was. I wanted to see what color his eyes were. I wanted to see his hands. I wanted to see what he was wearing. I wanted to hear his voice. And I got all that.
I also talked with Jay's family at one point during this whole reporting project. And I think for them, this was a really complicated experience. And I'm going to let Laura Banstra, his younger sister, kind of explain what it was like for his family to get this news.
This has been extremely painful. This whole year has been really hard. For us, I think we put Jay's tragic death behind us a long time ago. We all assumed that whoever did it was either dead or in jail. I don't think I ever thought the guy had gotten away with it. So I think for us, we really put it in our past. I mean, when we talk about Jay, we talk about him in fun terms. So when they found him, I think my mom's words were, it was bittersweet. You know, we're happy that they found someone and that he's going to pay for it. But it's been very hard on all of us and continues to be hard on all of us.
I think it's important to keep in mind that, especially in a case like this, where 30 years have passed, you know, there is some amount of settling that happens, and it can be really painful to drag it all up again. But at the same time, the families were so thankful to know that this person had finally been found, had been just living a free life, and now was in a jail in Everett. And it's not a simple experience for family members, but it is very powerful for them.
And Claire, I know you were in the courtroom for much of this trial. William Talbot was eventually convicted, right?
Yeah. Yeah, he was. It was not something I recommend, sitting through a murder trial. But what I found really interesting in this trial was that it was history making. You know, I was there covering it. The New York Times flew someone in to cover it. It was making headlines around the country and around the globe because it was the first time that forensic genetic genealogy had been successfully used and then the case had gone before a jury. But both the prosecution and the defense really downplayed that. They said, like, don't pay attention to this new technique. We don't want you to think about it. Don't pay attention to the fact that there's a bunch of reporters here. We want you to look at is this DNA evidence and what it says or what it doesn't say. And that was really interesting.
Basically, look at the evidence, not how we found it, not how we got to it.
Exactly. And you could say that for the prosecution's case, it worked because he was convicted largely based on that DNA evidence. It was the only concrete thing that tied him to these killings. And it left me with a lot of questions walking out of that courtroom in 2019, you know, about the precedent that this was going to set and what it said about the privacy of our genetic data and how, you know, the privacy or lack of privacy is becoming really important to cases like this.
Let's set out some of those concerns, because I'm feeling those as well. I'm wondering about the awareness that somebody has when they sign up for a consumer genetic testing service, about where their data could potentially be sold, about what happens to their data if they decide to upload it to a site that has an online database that could link you to many family members out in the public. And I'm just curious if we're opening the door to a really Orwellian stage of our most personal information being available to law enforcement.
I think that is a really good question, and I have been working on trying to answer it for the past couple of weeks. Before we get to some of the details, I do think it's really important to just lay out for people that this case was kind of the first in many ways, but forensic genetic genealogy has gotten so, so common since then, right? It's not just a case here or there. There is a database maintained by Professor Tracy Dowdswell, who studies criminology at Douglas University, just outside Vancouver, so another local connection. She has cataloged 870 cases to date where forensic genetic genealogy has been used. And this is not just solving crimes, it's also identifying victims of crimes or victims even of natural disasters. There have been 36 cases in Washington that have been solved or where someone's been identified with genetic genealogy. And I think it's really important to note that we do have a program through the Attorney General's office that's trying to make these investigations more common and more possible for different law enforcement agencies around here.
So what is the Attorney General's office doing to try to make it easier for law enforcement to use genetic genealogy?
Well, this stems out of a different program that they had, which is about sexual assault kits. You might have actually heard about this because it was huge news a few years ago.
Yeah, there's this big backlog of sexual assault kits that need to be tested, right?
Right. So these kits, in many cases, have DNA evidence of a perpetrator of sexual assault, but they had just been kind of sitting on shelves. They hadn't been sequenced and uploaded to that law enforcement database, CODIS. So AG Bob Ferguson started a program to get all of them into that database. And he told me it's been a really big success so far.
We have essentially eliminated that backlog. And the backlog was literally about 10,000 untested sexual assault kits. I'm not sure what word to use for that, but it is shocking and really indefensible.
So as they are sequencing all of this DNA, they discovered some of these cases were not getting hits in CODIS. So the person wasn't already in the law enforcement database. But some of them could be good candidates for a forensic genetic genealogy investigation. And much like Jay and Tanya's murder, some of the cases these kits are from are really horrific serial rapes or rapes and murders. So a couple years ago, the Attorney General's office applied for a grant through the Department of Justice and got it and have been giving money out to law enforcement agencies around the state to do these investigations. And when we talked, the AG made very clear that he thinks that this is working and successfully solving crime.
And cold cases that have gone cold for many, many years. And you can imagine, you know, what it might mean to an individual who or to a family to know that a law enforcement is still following up and still trying to solve these cases to bring justice for that individual and accountability for the person who perpetrated the crime.
And I don't think anybody would argue that solving murders and rapes is not a good thing. I mean, solving these kinds of cases seems like we can all agree that's a positive for society. Mm-hmm. I still, though, Claire, am getting this sinking sensation about the amount of information in our genes that people are sharing on the internet and that law enforcement has access to, possibly unbeknownst to us. I mean, what's happening with the privacy concerns here?
Right. Well, this is a really big question. And you think that people all over the place would be concerned about this and thinking about it, and we would have regulations around it. And that, you may be surprised to find out, is absolutely not what's happening. I talked to Natalie Ram about this. She is a scholar on genetic privacy at the Carey School of Law at the University of Maryland. And she explained to me that any restrictions around how this technique is used basically comes from the companies that run genetic databases.
Every platform has basically had to decide how it wants to embrace or not law enforcement use of its data. Even that control is somewhat limited, since law enforcement can and has lied about who it is and said, oh, I'm just uploading my own DNA, when what they're really doing is uploading crime scene DNA profiles.
So I want to be really clear about the various different platforms that Natalie is talking about here. You have these companies like 23andMe and Ancestry.com that have proprietary databases where you have to take a test through them to get into the database. And for those platforms, law enforcement pretty much needs a court order, like a warrant, to be able to get at the information. But the public platforms like GEDmatch, as one example, allow users to opt out of law enforcement searches, but automatically opt people into that data being available. And as a user, it can be confusing to navigate those different things and to understand exactly what you're signing up for.
Because you probably want to cast as wide a net as possible when you're trying to track down long-lost relatives, right? So many people may think, it's a great idea, opt me into this big public database, not realizing what it opens them up to.
Yeah, I think people are not really prepared for what they might find out when they take a DNA test, whether it is finding a relative they didn't know existed or unearthing a secret in their family, or, oh gosh, I kind of checked a box and said, sure, sign me up for law enforcement searches, but I didn't think that it might put someone I know behind bars. It's a really difficult thing to navigate, assuming that you're even able to kind of read through the terms of service and you're thorough about it and you really understand what you're signing up for. This is the main regulation on this technique right now, is what these private companies have decided they're going to do.
So platforms are basically policing themselves. Are there any states that are trying to step in with laws governing what they can and can't share?
Yeah, Maryland has a pretty restrictive law that requires oversight from a judge and says that it can only be used in certain cases, so cold cases and only violent crimes. And there's a much narrower law in Montana. And Texas is looking at governing this as well. There were actually four different bills introduced in the Texas legislature. It's not clear yet if any of them will become law. You know, lawmakers have until the end of May to figure out if any of them are going to make it through. So it's very rare for states to have laws on the books governing this. The other main source of regulation is from the Department of Justice. And so this applies to any federal law enforcement agencies or any local law enforcement agencies that have funding to do these kinds of investigations. And that includes any Washington agency that got money from the Attorney General's office to do one, for example. So the requirements that they have set, a lot of it is very technical about like the privacy of data and things like that. But there's some restrictions as well around what kinds of cases they can be used for. So it has to be violent crimes. And it has to be a case where police have pursued other reasonable leads. So it can't be like the first thing you try. And the Attorney General framed this to me as it's really only being used in Washington for cold cases at this point. So those are kind of the norms that the people who are thinking about this have settled on. It can only be used for violent crimes. It has to be used kind of as a last resort. But those norms aren't strict regulations outside of those few specific cases I laid out. For the vast majority of law enforcement agencies, they could use this whenever for whatever crime they wanted.
Claire, at the beginning of our conversation, you mentioned the University of Idaho murders.
Now to the shocking unsolved murders of those four University of Idaho students.
Four students who were killed.
Now police have yet to name a suspect or a motive, but they insist that the case is far from going cold.
The bodies were found last November.
We are getting our first look at the man who is in custody now.
There is a suspect who has been arrested and is going to be tried for this murder. How is forensic genetic genealogy playing into this case, and what questions is it raising?
Thank you for coming back to this, because this is a really big recent development in forensic genetic genealogy. So when the suspect in this case was arrested just before New Year's, several media outlets spoke to anonymous sources in Moscow, Idaho, where this happened, who said forensic genetic genealogy was actually used in this case to identify the suspect. Now, I want to be clear that I have not been able to confirm that. There's now a gag order on this case, so the police are not allowed to talk to the media about it at all. But it seems pretty significant that four different separate outlets got confirmation that they did this. Now, this would be a big shift in the norms if it's true, right? Because this is not a cold case. This was an ongoing active investigation. And it was a really scary case. People were afraid for their safety. So it makes sense that this might be a time where you would want to use forensic genetic genealogy in a way it hasn't been used before. But Natalie Ram from the University of Maryland voiced some real concern to me about the norms around how we use this shifting.
New techniques like investigative genetic genealogy are almost always used first in the least objectionable circumstances. The first big case we have is the Golden State Killer case. Who could be against finding a serial killer and rapist? Nobody. But like all police techniques, basically, once it is used and accepted for its best and most justifiable use case, its use starts to expand. And we saw this in the first year of investigative genetic genealogy, and we're seeing it continuing to expand in its use.
So if these norms start to shift, and remember, for most law enforcement agencies, these aren't strict regulations, they're just kind of the accepted best practice. If they start to shift, we could end up in a bit of a scary place, right? I think back to Chelsea Rustad's comment about how She didn't love that her DNA was used by the police, but she was okay with it because it put a double murderer behind bars. But what if it wasn't a double murder? What if it was someone who had only assaulted someone? What if, in like a really horrific case, it's someone in a different state who had an abortion and is now being arrested for having an abortion where it's not legal? This really opens the door to a different kind of ethical calculus, some possibilities that are pretty troubling. And it also asks some really broad questions about the precedent that's being set about DNA evidence and if we are comfortable with it being used this way.
All right, that's KUOW's Claire McGrain. Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to Soundside. And hey, this show is only possible because listeners support us. If you are able to give right now, check out the show notes for a link to donate. And don't forget, you can listen live on KUOW 94.9 FM Seattle at noon and 8 p.m., Monday through Thursday, or anytime online at KUOW.org.